Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. That the Arctic is warming is not exactly breaking news on a planet where almost everywhere is warming. But it is critical news that the planetary air conditioners, the Arctic and Antarctica, are warming faster than almost anywhere else. In the case of the Arctic, three times faster. Last year's Arctic report card called a spade a spade. It's almost certain 2023 was the Arctic's hottest summer in centuries. Massive wildfires, particularly in Canada, Greenland ice sheet melt in late June, which practically never happens, sea surface temperatures 5 to 7 degrees Celsius above normal in August. The list of firsts, or maybe better put, worsts, was a long one. Can those trends be mitigated, since they probably cannot be reversed in our lifetimes? Are there potential tipping points that might produce even faster change? Who should be doing what on a timescale that's relevant to people living today? And what can we learn from the deep history of people who have lived in the far north for centuries that might help us cope with these changes? Tero Mustonen is a Finnish environmental leader, scientist, and fisherman. He deeply believes that traditional knowledge needs to be combined with modern science to understand the planet's changing realities. More immediately, he recently returned from the Arctic, which gives us a rare opportunity for a firsthand debrief from someone who's been wandering the Arctic recently. Welcome back to New Thinking for New World, Tero. Good to see you.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be back.
Tero, I've been looking forward to this conversation and bugging you about it for some time, so thank you for doing this. But let's start with the trip. Where were you and what did you experience?
I work for an organization called Snow Change. It's an NGO based in Finland, but with the Arctic reach. So we work in Greenland, Alaska, Canada, Faroe Islands. Used to have a large Russia program, but now, of course, after the war, you can't do science there anymore. I was over there in Norway and Finnish Arctic and visiting about 10 different sites and starting the summers monitoring work and some of the engagements with also the indigenous Sami people in the Arctic.
I mentioned the Arctic report card. Last year was a bad year. What's going on now? What's it feel like?
Well, May was very complex. We had in the boreal and subarctic in Finland temperatures that jumped very fast up to plus 30. And even in boreal area of Finland, which is kind of in the subarctic, there was drought that was or essentially worst drought in 150 years. So it's early in the season. We haven't seen all of the same kind of a really big fire season that we had last year. However, we do know from public sources that there are large fires in Siberia. Also, the fire season is starting in Canada. And so it's kind of too early to call yet whether we are having another 2023 or not. But nevertheless, the start of the summer was riddled with very high temperatures in the boreal here in the order of plus 30, 32 degrees, even 35 at some locations.
What about ice coverage?
Everybody expected the winter to be very, very warm and be an indicator for climate change. Actually, the opposed effect happened. So, of course, European North gets a very complex climate. We are influenced by either the North Atlantic low pressure, bringing a lot of rain and precipitation, or a Siberian high, meaning in this case high pressure over Siberian. What actually happened was that we had a really cold winter. So even though it was a record warm in many parts of North American North and the Arctic, here we had minus 35 for weeks. We had really long winter that started already in early October in some parts of the Boreal and the Arctic here.
You mentioned in passing that you don't have access anymore, direct access to the Russian North, but anecdotes are available. Some reporting is available. Siberia had really bad fires a few years ago. Last year it was Canada's term. You mentioned that there are already reports of fires.
Yeah. I guess there are 2 points. We released last week something called Arctic Event Database, which is a collection of 8 sites across the whole region, including 3 sites in Russian Arctic that participated until the war. And these are communities that are combining their knowledge. It's often called indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge with science. And when you look at the Siberian cases, we learned new, baseline that in many parts of the Russian and Siberian North, the fires started to stretch into the tundra. So when people associate the North with forest fires, we are really talking about forests. However, now one of the new phenomena over the past few years has been tundra, open barren tundra fires that may burn through the winter. So that's because the fire remains underground and can last even through the winter. On the access of information to Russia or from Russia, of course, it's a kind of a complex moment in time. Russia has cut a lot of its scientific collaborations with the West, and they do represent one half of all of the Arctic area, the polar north. And therefore, the 30-year window that we had between 1990s and now is closed. And this has quite stark consequences for climate change studies and assessment of how and where are we on multiple critical indicators like permafrost, sea ice, and also fire. That's we can call fire one of the key Arctic indicators. However, a bypass around that is to have a safe access to some of the Russian news outlets that are still reporting, and of course they are reporting on things like very cold frosts in May that led in Western Russia to food security issues, and then in Siberia, deployment of fire troops to fight the early seasonal fires. So that's how we know indirectly some of the evidence of how, and of course satellites are the third, remote sensing satellites are a third way of tracking it. But in all honesty, we are in trouble. I'm not advocating that we should be having a dialogue with Russia, but I'm just noting that access to data and critically important events is now greatly cut.
Let me ask what's, I'm sure, going to sound like a dumb question. I understand what burns in a forest fire. What burns in a tundra fire? What's actually the fuel that feeds a tundra fire?
Yeah, that's a great question. In many parts of the tundra fires, it's peat, this organic layer, kind of topsoil or soils. And even if we call it treeless tundra, there's vegetation. One of the also, because of climate change, one of the proliferating dynamics in these open northernmost terrestrial or land ecosystems is now willow. So you have brushes, willows, and other things moving from the edge of the forest zone into the tundra. And they can, for their part, of course, be fuel as well. But what burns is the soils. And the way of course, you have a great variety of peatland soils in the Arctic and in the tundra. But when the fires are going out, they may linger on in the peat soils, even through the whole winter when it's minus 50 Celsius or and snow cover. And that's why some people call them ghost fires, because they last and linger through the whole long polar night, and then they burst or they reignite on the surface early in the season and start to proliferate again. And they are extremely hard to put out. So one of the key fuels for the for these tundra fires is a combination of peat soils and then some vegetation, of course, and lichen and some other species.
Do these fires raise the likelihood of the permafrost melting?
That's another very good question. Permafrost comes in many forms. Some of it is even coastal, like ocean permafrost, and those are really hard to track because they are, of course, underwater. By burning on top of the permafrost and with these new fires that are proliferating, of course, we will have a number of warming impacts, and they are also having cascading impacts on water table. So the way water travels also there are a couple of, shall we say, secondary steps like release of further mercury from these melting soils, and also flood events, erosion, and so on and so on. So it's a tricky combination, and the fire accelerates already something that's underway. We know that permafrost is melting in many parts, but the way it melts and how deep and what kind of a permafrost we are talking about varies. Alaska, Canada, and Siberia, Greenland are gigantic land masses and areas. And of course, we can have a headline like it's melting or there are now concerns, but you really have to do the spatial analysis and also the depth of the thaw. And not all people like the fact that you call it a melt. People in science tend to call it also permafrost thaw. But I think we should be looking at the use of the word melting, because the landscapes are permanently altered when permafrost is lost. Even here in Finland, on discontinuous permafrost called balsamire or peatlands.
What's the consequence of that process and the acceleration of that process, which it sounds like is what's happening?
Well, the easy answer is that we don't know. And then you get the usual climate narrative of reduction of emissions and so on and so on. Personally, over the past 30 years traveling in all parts of the Arctic, and I used to spend a lot of years and within those years in Siberia, tracking the impacts before the war, I have a tendency to think that it's a kind of a new lands are emerging. One of the things that we are having very little capability as a global society to understand is that humanity will have a new ocean in our hands soon. And what I mean by that is that the ocean sea ice that's currently, shall we say, around North Pole, may be lost within our lifetimes, even in the next 15, 20 years. This will trigger kind of a minor revolution in transportation. You can now take ships across an area that used to be frozen. It will be of significance in fisheries interest. There's an international agreement that is trying to restrict that or have a precautionary principle, but nevertheless, these are huge, massive assets of all sorts of natural extractive resources in the ocean. And finally, there's something called species on the move if we look at the biological side. So a lot of the temperate and southern species are headed to the Arctic and beyond. And this puts a lot of these colder endemic species under stress, because they have nowhere to go. And of course, then you finally you have the climate file. So we know that from permafrost melt or thaw, there may be very consequential methane releases and CO2 consequences or carbon consequences. And while not wanting to be of joining the tipping points class or narrative, I think we are witnessing a systemic change in the Arctic. And this will have implications for the global weather system and the whole planet, because the Antarctica and Greenland and other parts of the Arctic are our fridge. They are the ones that cool us down. They are the ones that enable survival of human societies in China, in Africa, in Latin America. They keep the U.S. cities in check, or shall we say, the best climate security that we have is to keep the Arctic as cool as possible.
That's true, but it's also true, as you've just described, that we are witnessing in real time changes that only a few years ago most would have thought would have taken decades and decades, but they're happening at a much faster pace. And you just described, it is what it is. It isn't a question of, is this happening? It is happening. It may not even be a question of, can it be stopped? It is a question of adjustment and adaptation. Or is that too pessimistic?
Well, I don't think it's a question of pessimism or optimism at this time. I think it's a context where we should be looking at the facts, no matter what your society or cultural orientation is, and building on those facts we know. These are not models. These are observed real things that are happening, both on the biodiversity side. Species are in a flux. Human societies will have either both losses and opportunities. And then the question becomes, what are the futures we want? We can still slow down large portion of some of these things. So I'd like to think that in the sense that we can find ways to navigate, shall we say, a warmer Arctic, but it requires an understanding that it's not all out there to be looted all at once. We should have a process. And of course, there are some processes like the Arctic Council, but this will be a weaker policy instrument. Now that things are moving into a very big geopolitical interest, mainly natural resources and so on and so on, we also have to have leaders that are capable of having a process in place where we'll make sure that the remaining wilderness areas are intact, because even in a warming world, that carbon needs to stay on the ground. I'm mostly referring to areas like Hudson Bay ecoregion in North America. That's the third largest probably carbon store. A single ecoregion that stores a third of world soil-based carbon, or in the peatlands, the largest peatland ecosystem. A huge, massive carbon store that needs to be staying there. Same for Alaska, same for Western Siberia. These peatlands and associated ecosystems, no matter what kind of a world we are living in, needs to be functioning and, shall we say, kept in check. Now, on the other hand, we are living exactly in the world where we are. More people, more interest, warmer, and so on and so on. I'd like us to have a conversation at some point as a global society on climate security, how climate is actually a national security issue. Like we had a report with Sir David King about 7 years ago on, he's in the UK, a former advisor to the prime ministers, and together with a large coalition from the US, China, the UK, and some of the others, there was a group of 20 people that argued to the world leaders that, look, Climate change is here. This is the list of things that how it will go, but it's not only a natural phenomenon. It's a direct national security threat, for example, to the U.S. And I think that the U.S. Navy understands that. When I spoke at that time with the representatives of your Navy, they were very clear that the first idea of a priority for the Navy is to protect national security. And they themselves had identified that sea level rise and some of these big things, a lot of them in the Arctic, are constituting a direct concern. And therefore, it penetrates or is kind of a cross-sectoral issue for those societies that can still act. And that's kind of a perhaps on an extremely complex topic, my view.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Let's go back for a second to the carbon sinks in the Arctic, Hudson Bay, Siberia, forests in north of Europe. You made the case, I think, quite eloquently that you need to retain those sinks. Those sinks shift to sources of carbon, and it becomes really quite difficult. We see the same thing in the rainforests in Congo and in Brazil. What can be done? What are you doing to try to sustain, in a warming world, those carbon sinks?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's also one of the most difficult questions because we are having the old stupid sentence, but we'll have one planet. Doesn't really change. We won't go to Mars in time. We won't have, unless I'll be meeting UFOs outside this conversation soon. Let's also rule out the extraterrestrial escape route. So we have to come back to the understanding that there's only one planet here. Increased population, everybody wants better life, everybody wants no war, and people want to live. This will then require, and I'm really talking on the global level here, it will require us to come to the table again, no matter how hard these things are, to agree to the fact that the planet will not able to be functioning if we don't have a land treaty or a mechanism that some people call it 30 by 30, which is a kind of a IPCC and other forums statement on we need to restore and protect 30% of the planet by 2030. Or some other sentences like half Earth, half of the functioning ecosystems should be left alone. At the key or core of this question to me is that a global land treaty where some areas are left outside industrial interest and large-scale human intervention, for example, from extractive industries like lithium mining or seabed mining, is the only way forward. It also implies that industries, the economy, and those sectors that nobody wants to talk about, but they are here because they are enabling our iPads and cell phones and everything, will stay. We will have to use natural resources. So therefore, this kind of a, I'll call it for argument's sake here, an international land and ocean treaty. Of course, there's no such single treaty, but this could be a framework for that, would contain clear elements of equity and conservation for those parts like Hudson Bay ecoregion where we know that touching those peatlands will eliminate another part of the lungs of the earth. So why should we go there? On the other hand, why can't we look at some of the exciting new prospects on elsewhere and in ways that are getting more out of those ore metals or mined minerals that we have already taken out of the earth or some of the other functionality. So I have found it hard over the past, shall we say, 5 years to understand why we have to still in this time with all of these facts open up new ecologically pristine habitats for a human need when we could recycle, do better, more innovation using those areas that are already being used. And lastly, of course, I'm a big proponent of ecosystem restoration. So we could also increase some of these numbers and targets by looking at those areas where rewilding restoration works. I'm not saying everything should be restored, but it is one of the most powerful mechanisms to look at degraded land. And the European Union just passed yesterday, Monday, 17th of June, a sweeping ecosystem restoration law, which means that 20% of European Union land by law has to be restored across the whole continent. And it starts to be on the level of that kind of a land treaty that I was talking about as a solution. And why not? I have never understood that. Why don't we meet the challenges of these times where we are? I know that change hurts and it's fearful, but it's better to do it now when we still can and we have the mechanisms to try for it rather than in 40 years when it's boiling and it will also cost billions and billions more.
Let's shift slightly the focus, or narrow the aperture, perhaps is a better way to put it, to rewilding peatlands, which you and your organization have, I don't know if you've pioneered, but you put an awful lot of effort and energy exactly into that. And it is, as you just said, restoring ecosystems in very practical ways. I know you've recently added territory to that initiative. Tell us a bit about where that stands and what you're trying to do.
Well, thank you for asking about that. It's always been our focus here in Finland, I think more broadly also, to focus on the practical solutions. We are a small nation struck between a large neighbor to the east and then new friends in the US with the NATO membership and all. So, therefore, we can also ask, what is the role of small nations in a geopolitical era like this one? And I think the landscape rewilding program that I lead, which is part of Snow Change, tries to demonstrate that while we will not be an entity that will restore or safeguard all of the Arctic, we are currently at 55,000 hectares over 112 sites, making us the largest operator in Finland on restoration of these critically important carbon lands and peatlands. And the other big news is that in May, just a few weeks ago, Government of Finland and Snow Change signed a framework agreement where, for the first time in Finnish history, we are now restoring on public lands as well. So we used to have 55,000 hectares, or I guess it's like 150,000 acres over over 100 sites. But now the government has come forward and said, okay, we like what you are doing. Our bank is empty. So why don't you work with us on public land as well? And I think that kind of a model we have been restoring now for over 15 years. And I think the message that I can give forwards is not so much about the numbers. They are great and we have huge sites and yada, yada, yada. But I think it's in an international context, far more important to demonstrate that even in this time, in time of multiple crises, the climates and so on and so on, completely new models can be crafted that are meeting the critical interest of indigenous peoples, the communities, and now the state of Finland comes forward and says, well, you are doing the work in any case. Here's some more lands and targets that police start to work on. And that demonstrates a model that we hopefully could export in many other parts of the Arctic. What I'm trying to say is that there are new, completely new novel solutions going on, and that's where I see a lot of the hope, because in my line of work, I'm mostly interested in, do the animals come back or don't? Does the peatland get better or water quality? Are we actually advancing? And that's a very powerful narrative that's happening in front of your own eyes, that things are getting better.
And to connect two dots in our conversation, restoring the peatlands, rewilding the peatlands, is also about maintaining that carbon in the ground.
That is true. So United Nations has issued several statements on how perhaps one third of world soil-based carbon, meaning huge amount of carbon, is in the peatlands, especially in the northern part of the planet. And when we restore those peatlands that have been affected by ditching or forestry activities or mining, we are keeping that carbon on the ground, and we are also restarting carbon sequestration in the sense that they draw down CO2 and store it for us. So, of course, it won't solve all parts, but they are also water filters. So clean water, better rivers, comebacks of northern and other species that are dependent on those things. But first and foremost, it's a huge carbon action, and therefore, essentially, we can't afford to get any more CO2 into the atmosphere.
As we end our conversation today, I should have mentioned that you are a past recipient of the Telberg SNF Elias and Global Leadership Prize. And one of the reasons why the jury recognized you a couple years ago, the same reason why they've recognized other scientists working in the environmental space like Sylvia Earle, Meg Lauman, Asha DeVos, is not just because you're doing good science, but because, as you've just discussed, you're working on solutions is a big word. You're trying to have real world impact directly in making the kind of change that is viable economically, that makes sense politically, and is good for the planet. And it is that you talked about the need for leadership. Leadership comes in many forms, and I think the kind of leadership you're demonstrating, but also the other people I just mentioned, is at least as important, maybe more important, given the quality of political leadership at the moment, because you're actually doing stuff. And the final point you did just make is that too many climate discussions are literally hopeless. And so you end up saying, well, I can't do anything. It's just all going wrong. But as you've pointed out, there are lots of things that need to get done urgently. And that is, I think, fundamentally your message and the message of snow change.
Yeah. Of course, we are very thankful to the Thalberg Foundation for recognizing the work very early on. And in summary, I enjoy these conversations with you, Alan, because you are one of those people that can reach out to all parts of the world and find out novel and sometimes perhaps disturbing facts, but also leaders and thinkers and so on who are willing to engage on your critical questions. And I would also just add one last thing, which is that if people want to find out about the Arctic and they go to the snowchange.org, where we have our new databases under the news section, they'll find authentic voices of hunters, women, fishers from many villages that have been sharing now their knowledge, perhaps for the first time in some parts, trusting that the world needs to hear messages from the people that are still not the enemies of nature, and have found, I don't want to use the word harmony, but a relatively sustainable way of engaging with a very tough place on the planet, the Arctic. So there's a way of learning about the Arctic through these people's voices that's very different than looking at the BBC Blue Planet or some of the other, shall we say, quick looks at the region. So again, a big thank you, and I wish everybody a great summer.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.